Hi, it's John Moe. We'll start our episode in just a moment, but first, I live in Minnesota, which means that I'm deciding whether to add crumbled up potato chips to the hot dish that I'm making. Why am I making a hot dish? Well, because I'm going to a block party. Geez, you know, you gotta bring a hot dish to a block party. Okay, you know what, actually, I'm reading this invitation a bit more carefully. This is the Maximum Fun Block Party, going on now through October 22nd. Geez, that's a super long block party, hey? But it's virtual, so you can have some of my virtual hot dish. The tuna and noodles and potato chips are all theoretical. During the Maximum Fun Block Party, Max Fun shows are releasing episodes that are specially welcoming to new audiences, like this one that you're about to listen to now. So if you've been encouraging a friend to try out our show, Depresh Mode, this is the perfect episode to share with them. It's also a great time to check out shows that you've been curious about, since they're releasing new episodes geared towards new audience members as well. To get you started, I can recommend a lot of the hosts who you've heard on our show. Janet Varney, for instance. She has a podcast on Maximum Fun called the JV Club Podcast, and it's just as delightful and fun as hanging out with Janet is, because it is hanging out with Janet, really. Honestly, Travell Anderson and Jarrett Hill, you've heard both of them on here. They have a show called Fanti. That's a show where they look at the downside of things that they also love. It's kind of a fascinating look at sometimes the ambivalence of pop culture. And Laura House, who we talked to about meditation, has Tiny Victories with Annabelle Gurwitch. And that's a show that will give you a little boost, a little short little uplifting show that's going to get your day started off right. The Block Party also has games, recommendations, a volunteer event, a limited edition poster, and more. Find out more about all that fun stuff. Oh, geez, you're going to have a good time over at MaximumFun.org/Block Party. Tell your friends. People sometimes ask me about how I do what I do in my job, specifically asking other people about their mental health issues. How do I come right out and ask about someone's depression, their trauma, their disorders, the ways in which mental illness has made their life harder? How do I develop the nerve, the bravery, the guts to just come out and ask about it here on the show? It's Depresh Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. And my answer is always the same. It's not bravery or guts or anything like that. I just forget. I forget that in our society, you're not supposed to ask about stuff like that. You're not supposed to ask about someone's suicidal ideation or their time in a treatment facility or how they've tried to address their issues. I forget because it's something that I've been doing at work for many years now. It's a societal taboo, but one that I cross so often that it just slips my mind that it is a taboo. And part of the reason for me forgetting about those boundaries is that the people I interview have agreed to lower their boundaries. They know I'm going to ask about stuff like that. They agreed to the interview. So here we go. I won't spring it on you in the produce section if I meet you there. It's planned during the podcast. But even with all that, mental health is not an easy topic for anyone. Because those mental low points hurt when they were happening, and they hurt to talk about now. It's painful. It's scary. Here's the thing, though. People who get this stuff off their chest tend to feel better. Because, I mean, who likes having heavy things on their chest? And people who are in the public eye are often pleasantly stunned by the positive response they receive when they open up about mental health. It inspires their followers. It opens them up to receive more love. I was thinking about all of this after I talked to Tom Sharpling. Tom is the longtime host of The Best Show with Tom Sharpling, an internet radio show formerly known as The Best Show on WFMU when it was on regular radio. The Best Show is long-form comedy. Tom does the show with his friend and comedy partner, the musician John Worster. The Best Show has a deeply devoted following. Friends of Tom, they're called. Besides doing radio, Tom was also a television writer for the show Monk throughout the run of that program. He's done a lot of directing, producing. He was the voice of Steven's dad on Steven Universe. And he has a new memoir, It Never Ends, where Tom opens up about suicidal ideation, the inpatient care and electroconvulsive therapy he received as a teenager, and the memory loss that resulted from that. He and I had lived in New Jersey around the same time, coincidentally, me in graduate school at Rutgers University, him in a hospital on the campus of Rutgers University. The mental health stuff is subject matter that he hasn't talked about publicly before. I asked if there were a lot of people demanding that he write a book.
A couple people were saying, hey, write a book. It wasn't like there was some mass movement, to some petition to get me to finally write a book. It was kind of...
crowds at the door waving pitchforks.
There were no pitchforks, no crowds. It's something I always wanted to do and was very, very moved to do it right if I was going to do it or when I was going to do it. And initially I thought I would maybe do some kind of fiction thing or something that was more just straight comedy on the lighter side of things. But then it just felt like if I was going to do one, the first one I needed to do was like the book I did, where I just wanted to tell my story and kind of clear the decks in a lot of ways and just own who I am. And then I felt like I could move forward from there if I did that. And that's really what I ended up doing.
And like a lot of people, I was familiar with The Best Show. I was familiar with Monk. I didn't realize until I read the book that, oh, there's a lot of mental health history here. It's not something that you've talked about before with your mental health struggles and your depression.
Yeah, no, I really didn't talk about it at all. I mean, I think it would come through that I was fully aware that I was not... I never tried to put myself across as someone who had everything figured out. I just would own that I had problems, but I never got specific with problems or never went into the past with them, because it just never felt like, it just didn't feel like the right place to do it necessarily on the radio. It felt like there's too many variables to tell it incorrectly. And it also... it kind of felt like I was, not that it was be too big for the radio, but I just felt like I needed to do it in a way that matched the scope of what I was going to say and not just have it be just another episode of the show.
Not a tossed off comment here and there.
Exactly.
Let's get a picture of your mental health history here. When did your mental health problems, obstacles, issues emerge in your childhood?
Yeah, probably around 10, I guess. That's when stuff started to surface.
And what did that feel like? How did that present?
Just a lot of anxiety and confusion and feeling not comfortable in my own skin or feeling like I didn't, it just felt like things didn't make sense. And you're not sure where to put stuff, like you're feeling things, but you're not sure where to put those feelings.
How did you handle it then?
I pretty much tried to just push everything down and just power past it and not really, there really weren't avenues to express it. I did meet with a therapist a couple times as a kid, and at least that acknowledged that something was happening to some degree in my life, but it wasn't like, it was something that I was also allowed to kind of push past. And then I ended up going back to therapy, I guess, probably a few years later when I was starting high school. I guess would have been about when I went back.
I'm always curious how people address something like that, given how they were growing up and like in their community. When I was growing up, I heard the term, it's just a phase. And I kept waiting for the phase to end. How was the whole thing seen in your world?
How it was just everything's your own private business, and you didn't share it with anybody, and you kept everything a secret, and it just wasn't. It was really, those were very different times, because you just didn't say you had mental problems. That just, you just, it was not what you talked about. And my family was just like a lot of other families, where you just keep your business under your roof and try to take care of it, but you're not broadcasting it to everybody. But you can acknowledge it within your family. It's not like my family denied that I was having these problems at all. They were trying to find answers and trying to help. But it also wasn't the open society nearly to how it is now, where you could just talk about these things and there's less and less of a stigma attached to any of them.
Well, thank you for bearing with me, because I know I'm getting to the most painful part right off the bat in the interview. Thanks for hanging in. You talked about how you returned to therapy in high school. Had it been a matter of depression not being an issue in the intervening years, or had you held it at bay?
I would assume I held it at bay. These are some of the things I can't remember due to memory loss. That is a byproduct of the mental illness. Yeah, a lot of this stuff is just very blurry to me and very vague. And I know I went early, didn't go, went back. I can't tell you anything. I couldn't tell you who I saw when I went the first time. I could not tell you who I saw the second time. I just remember where it was. I couldn't tell you the person's name, the therapist's name. I'm a lot of missing spots, which I'm sure we will fill in the blanks on why I have those.
Yeah, well, I want to get to that, and I want to get at plenty of comedy too. It's important to lay the groundwork, but you know, I don't want to live there forever. Oh,
I'm not complaining. This is where we're at. I signed up for it. This was not a bait and switch. It's in the show title.
Yeah, Tom, are you comfortable talking into microphones? Do you have a lot of experience into microphones? So the memory, does it cover when you went into inpatient care? Do you remember it? Do you remember why you went in, when you went in, what it was like?
Yeah, I do remember going in and getting. Speaking of Rutgers, my trip at Rutgers, maybe a little different than yours. You were studying graduate stuff. Me, they threw me in a facility and locked the door.
Well, I was in the theater department, so it wasn't.
No,
that
we
different.
Might have been doing the same thing, but in different departments. Just being overly dramatic and
screaming a lot,
screaming a lot of sadness and crying,
tears.
Yeah. But, no, it was, I just remember saying to, my therapist or psychologist, I guess, that I remember saying I really wanted to kill myself, and just saying it in a way that was very defiant, like I owned it. And then it was like, uh-oh, I immediately got swept up. That's I guess one of the big red flags for a mental health professional to hear, that they have to follow protocol on. And the protocol was that I ended up getting agreed to do it. I don't know. I just I ended up in a hospital facility on the Rutgers campus.
And how old were you at this point?
17, 16, 17. Yeah.
And there intermittently through high school. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about inpatient care. You know, it's in a padded room and you're in a straitjacket, and also the misconception of you'll always be rehabilitated and you'll be fine. And there's a lot in between. What was it like for you? Was it a therapeutic thing? Were you getting better?
The first time, absolutely not. No, I was placed in the wrong type of care. This was for kids that really acted out and were really aggressive and they had problems with others. I really just had problems with myself. My things were all within my head, and that's what I needed help with. And yeah, it was not the right place for me to get the treatment that I needed at all. And then, but what that did is it taught me how to, I figured that out pretty fast, that I don't fit here. These kids are bigger problems than I am. And just kind of falling into the, my general pattern is to just be a fixer and figure things out and solve things. And then I just tried to figure out how do I get through this? And then I figured out just by being good, they were equating being good with being better. And so I just was as good as I could be. And then I got through that without really getting anything treated. But I was just I wanted to get out. I didn't want to be there. So whatever that took, I would do. And I did. I mean, it's just so hard to picture a kid going like, No, I know what's best for me. And even though I see this here, I'm going to play by the rules and hand myself over to this. It's like, no, you don't. I didn't think it was fair that I was in there. I wanted out and I acted accordingly. So I just was perfectly behaved. And then they let me out after a month or so.
And how did that go back at home after that?
I guess there's an initial wave of euphoria just to not be in the hospital anymore. But then it went back to where it was. The problem still surfaced and then just came back full bore. And yeah, because nothing had been treated.
Was it all suicidal ideation or were there attempts?
At that point, there were no attempts at that point. I'm pretty sure, almost positive there were no attempts.
Okay.
There'd just been a lot of talk.
And then did that talk get you sent back to a different hospital? Is that how it worked?
Well, I got out of the one and then then I did make an attempt, swallowed a bottle of pills, a few months after getting out of the hospital, out of the first one. And then that got me sent to like a serious one, for the second go round. Which was down in Princeton. There, look, we're covering all the bases. We're getting all the, yeah. So that was my tour. Two stops.
And what happened at that one?
Oh, that one I was in for, that one was serious business. And it was all adults. I was the only kid in there. And it was pretty rough because then they were just giving me electroconvulsive therapy to treat it.
Electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT, it changed Tom Sharpling's life, for better and for worse. Back with Tom Sharpling and talking about his electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT, treatment. ECT is a treatment that goes back centuries. It's often been seen as very effective and has also often been seen as problematic or even barbaric. It was certainly portrayed that way in the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But it's widely practiced today with minimal side effects and with a lot of acceptance. Tom's treatment happened during his high school years. What year was that? Do you know?
87, 86, 87, something like that.
So that was a while ago. How did ECT treatment, how was that conducted at the time? Pardon the pun.
I will not pardon that pun, first of all.
That's fair. Thank you.
So it was just pretty brutal. It was like you get put on a table and put in a room. And again, my memory is hazy on this stuff. The ECT,
because of the ECT?
Oh, absolutely. The ECT wiped out massive amounts of my memory. massive. And I've looked into what a ECT does to memory, and I'm on the far spectrum of getting the memory loss. Some people lose memory short term. They lose memory for the windows that it happened in, like just the recovery period afterwards. I lost just massive swaths of memory from so much of my life up until when this happened. And that is one of the possible side effects of it. And it's one of the ones I got. I got the hardest, one of the most severe results from it I got, which is just giant chunks of my memory are gone.
How long is the protocol for that?
The protocol for what?
For the ECT. How many sessions? How long did it last?
You know, I have tried to track down what literally happened, and I'm not sure it was over. I think a 6-week period, and I think it might have been one or two a week. I'm not sure on this, and I tried to get answers and contact doctors, and no answers. It's all speculative for me in that regard.
And what was your depression and ideation like after that?
It did lift. It did whatever it accomplished, whatever it was supposed to accomplish, it did accomplish. I was not suicidal anymore. It broke up whatever was going on in my brain that was really making these bad connections. It worked, but I paid a price for it. But, you know, it did work.
Do you think about whether it was worth it?
Well, yeah, I did think about it all the time. I've thought about it for my entire... As soon as I realized what happened, I've thought about it. And I've never stopped thinking about it because it sucks. And it's really unfortunate. But it's also, if I had gone untreated, or if I had gotten treated, say, through medication, I would not be anywhere near where I'm at right now in terms of my life. I probably would not be alive, because the one doctor had said that basically the amount of medication it's going to take for me to get right will take an enormous toll on my body, my liver and kidney and all that stuff. Like that, just like the strain of that much medicine, I was going to pay a pretty severe price in a different way. So
yeah,
it's one of those things where it's like, I gotta take it. I got to accept that this is what happened. Cause first of all, you know, I don't have any other choice. It happened. I can't go back. But also I do see, I paid a price, but I'm still here. So, and that was definitely not a certainty in any way prior to that. It was getting very bad, and it was very scary, because I was actually, you start to realize there's just a difference between thinking about it and actually trying it. That leap is huge, because look, I still think about everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people I know get a vague comfort from thinking about death, because you just know it's inevitable and it's an option, and it just makes you feel like you have some sort of, not control over your life, but you have perspective on what life is when you understand how easily life can go away. So there's always just like a weird comfort that comes from that sometimes. Because then I'm choosing to live then. It's just like, when you get through that thinking, you're saying, well, I have chosen to stay alive, so let's do something with it since I'm choosing to be alive. And look, it's a tricky game to play, and I can only speak for myself on this stuff, But that's how it feels for me, is there's is a weirdly positive thing that comes out of when I go on those swoons and think about death and how I could kill myself and stuff. It's really just theoretical, and it hasn't been anything other than theoretical since I was in the hospital. I've never really had any bouts where it's like, I'm going to try this again. It's never come anywhere near that. I mean, look, I've gone down to the ocean and looked at it and been just like, yeah, I could just walk in there now. And then that would be a wrap on Tom, but I'm not doing it. And I wouldn't do it. I do appreciate life, and I appreciate my life. And it's taken me a long time to get to this point where I kind of finally feel like my life is making some version of sense. And I want to get as much of it as I can now.
Something I really liked about the book, and the memoir is called It Never Ends, subtitled A Memoir with Nice Memories, mm-hmm. is that you write about all these experiences in the hospitals and with the treatment, and then you go out into the world on these kind of wobbly dough legs, but it's framed by knowing what you've come out of. It helps understand what you go into. You have what seems like a pretty clear vision of wanting to write and later get into comedy. It feels really mission-driven, and I wonder if that's a correct read on my part of the book.
Yeah, it's just a series of things that are maybe, if they're not contradictions, they definitely don't fit together, but it was making sense in my own head to just, it was always like, here's a situation, what's my reaction to the situation, what's something I can control in relation to the situation, and it took a long time for me to realize that a lot of my positivity about things and encouraging myself and others to be the best version of themselves, to try, to do, all of that is ultimately me reacting to the inherent negativity and doom that is at my foundation. Like I always, for a long time, I thought, well, no, I am a naturally positive person. That is, if you strip it all away, at the bottom of my heart is positivity. And then I realized it's like, well, no, at the very bottom of my heart is negativity that I am working to override and counter. That is, and it's to realize that final level was negativity, not positivity, was so mind-bogglingly, I was so out of touch with that it was, when I hit on that in therapy, I was speechless from the magnitude of realizing that about myself, because it explained everything.
When did that happen?
What time is it? No, I'm kidding.
yeah, I just got back from my therapist. I was on the yes. bus and then.
yeah. I was like 40 minutes ago. That was 5 years ago.
Yeah. That's really interesting to me because I often talk to people about this oldest voice that they know, which is that darkness and depression. And it speaks in a way that sounds just like your logical mind, but it's mm-hmm. crazy making. It's full of distortions. It's full of twistings of things, but it sounds so familiar that you think it's the truth.
Absolutely. No, there is so much. You don't realize how much faulty storytelling goes on that you have just accepted, the same way people accept certain truths without ever knowing where that truth started. It's just like, well, that's how we do it here, is ultimately at the bottom of so many dumb things that people believe with all of their heart, and they cannot tell you one practical, logical reason why you would do a thing outside of, well, that's how they did it before I got here, and I'm I was told this is how we do it, and I'm not going to rock the boat because this is true. And you realize it's like, oh my God, we're living just a series of those. Like it is just a list of those until you start to really analyze your life and hold yourself truly, put all of it up for grabs. You can just believe those things till the end of time.
And be guided by them to an alienating point in your life.
Oh, absolutely. No, they don't go away. They just get stronger until you challenge them. They only get stronger because with every passing year, they're more entrenched.
Here's something I found intriguing about your story, how you describe it in the book, is that you have this foundational darkness that deep down is still there, but yet you have sufficient connection with other people, for lack of a better term, a can-do spirit about the world and the people in the world, that then you can go out and hit it off with people like John Worster, your comedy partner, and develop the show. And you can get to know a guy on MTV who goes and starts Monk, and you're part of that. You seem to have a ton of really adept social skills for somebody with such depression at the heart of what you're doing. So is it a constant defiance of that, or how does that work?
It's just like there's two things going on concurrently, and it depends which one is driving the bus at any given time. I know that that positivity that I can exhibit is real, and it's not performative. It's how I truly see the world and want the world to be. And me being funny in the face of that or with it is, because I also know it's horrible too. I also know the horrible part of it too. They're parallel concepts, and they're both real within me. They're both as real as can be. And I have to accept that both of them exist. And if I want to accomplish the things I want to accomplish, whether I'm doing them for validation purposes or whatever that is a whole other thing. But I do think ultimately I'm funny, and I like being funny because I know I'm funny. So I want to do something with it and see how far I can take that in my life and see how far being funny can get me with things. It's kind of, I did get handed whatever special gift this is that my brain worked out that way, that I have this. I know it's a gift, and I don't take that lightly. So I want to do stuff with it, because it's like, it really is like having a superpower to be able to do that stuff and to take the awful world and find a way to make it funny for myself and for other people is a real gift. And I am grateful that I have that gift. And I'm grateful that I do like people and like knowing people and being friends with people and sharing my life with people and helping the people that I care about. It's all real, but it's a constant maintenance and a constant process to keep on the positive side without getting also manic with manic positivity is like so inauthentic and scary to me. It's just a different version. It's like your depression is wearing a different jacket or something, because on the outside it looks positive, but then you realize, oh, it's coming from a very unhealthy place. And if I ever feel myself getting manic with it, I know that I'm heading into an inauthentic place and it's not going to sustain. So I got to just make some adjustments. And I'm much better at that now also too. That just like, I realize I can't by force of will do everything, but there have been points where I thought I could, that it's just like, no, well, that's really, because if you follow any sort of like self-help, motivational people accomplishing stories of success, there are always the point when the person hits a roadblock, and then they outwork the roadblock, and you're like, no, that's valid, but it's not always valid. You can't outwork everything. But if you believe that, and then you're setting yourself up for some sort of crash.
You talk about who drives the bus, and it makes me think of the conscious management of keeping the darkness, the depression, however you want to term it, from overwhelming things. Are you the dispatcher at the bus depot then? Do you get to determine who drives the bus, or do they just show up behind the wheel?
Oh, they're behind the wheel. I show up. I'm just like, yeah, look who's driving the bus today. Uh-oh.
Oh, my.
This might not be a good one. Or it's like, oh, okay. You're a good bus driver. You're nice.
But you can't throw the bad driver off the bus?
No, they work there. I can't. Their union is very strong. I can't. I just like the amount that it would take. It's like they're tenured professors. Uh-huh. And I can't just fire them.
Because we've talked about buses and New Jersey, I just keep thinking of Port Authority in the 90s, and I'm getting very troubled.
I thought you were going to say, you could have just said, we were talking about depression, and I started thinking about Port Authority. Because that's
a physical shrine to depression.
Yeah. Yeah. My electroconvulsive therapy did not erase any Port Authority memories, unfortunately. I did not get to choose what went away. And I could have used some of the nights of going in to see a band and getting stuck. I park in Port Authority once thinking, oh, that's a good place to park your car when you come into Manhattan. And then I didn't realize it's like, oh, the garage is not 24 hours. And I had to wait till like 5 a.m. to get my car out. Jeez. And then a guy was like, you want me to get help you? I could walk into your car, and I almost did it. It's just like, that would have been the dumbest thing I could have ever done. Like, I would not be here now either.
If only you had the ability to choose what memories get blotted out.
Yeah, it's like a Charlie Kaufman movie just waiting to happen.
More just ahead with depressed suicidal guy turned comedy kingpin Tom Sharpling.
Does our podcast deep dive into the weirdest Wikipedia pages we can find?
Yes. Do we learn about scam artists, remote islands, horrible mascots, beautiful diseases, and mythical monsters?
Yes, 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 absolutely, and yes. Do we retain any of this knowledge?
Probably not. I'm Emily Heller.
I'm Lisa Hannawalt.
We make art and comedy and TV shows and also the podcast Baby Geniuses. For the past 8 years, we've been trying to learn new things about the world and each other every episode.
But let's be honest, this podcast is mostly about two friends hanging out, shooting the breeze, and making each other laugh. We're horny, we like gardening and horses, and we get real stupid on here.
But like, in a smart way.
Yeah.
Join us every other week on Maximum Fun. Baby Geniuses, tell us something we don't know.
A man goes to the doctor and says that he's depressed and that life seems cruel. The doctor says, ah, the treatment is simple. The great clown Pagliacci is in town tonight. Go and see him and you will surely feel better. The man bursts into tears and says, but doctor, I am Pagliacci. Ah, okay, says the doctor. In which case, try listening to the Beef and Dairy Network podcast. The Beef and Dairy Network podcast is a multi-award-winning comedy podcast, and you can find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with Tom Sharpling, the name Billy Crystal comes up in this next segment. It's in reference to a 2006 comic relief appearance where Crystal played an old jazz man. It was part of the benefit after Hurricane Katrina. 10 years later, Sharpling did a kind of walkthrough of that bit, blasting Crystal for being clueless, racist, completely out of touch, unfunny, and generally awful. It got Tom quite a bit of attention. You can look up that bit on the internet. It's on the internet. I want to talk about comedy a little bit, too, because when I started doing podcasts about depression, the comedians were the first people I went to, mostly because they could articulate the experience. They could articulate any experience in such a human way. It makes me think about when you're working on something to create on TV or radio mm-hmm. or a movie, does the humor for you come from what human experience or lived experience I can put across here? Or is it, this is a fun joke to throw in here. Like, how is the humor formed for you?
Oh, the humor is always, look, there's different versions of it. There's versions where it is, oh, that's a funny joke. That's it. It's a funny play on words. Concept has no relation to me or my life. Those are great, and I love those. But I also do love taking a situation and that's happening to me or has happened to me or I'm scared of happening and mining that is also very satisfying because then it's me saying the thing. It's not just a writerly thing that anybody could have come up with. And it just gives a certain amount of the perspective could only come from one place. It's coming. It's like, well, this is Tom saying this. This is Tom's take on that. And those are the ones that last the longest to me because they're coming from the way I see the world, not just from, oh, I spotted a little, the joke equivalent of a math problem. Where it's like, oh, if you reverse these words, then it's a thing. That's math, basically, and that's fine. And I love comedy that is that, but I just don't live there. I prefer stuff that is tied back to ultimately how I see the world.
I'm interested when you talk about the positivity and thinking the best of people because, you know, at the same time, I was listening to a famous bit that you did talking about Billy Crystal's thing at the Comic mm-hmm. Relief post-Katrina. And at the heart of that is just, oh, Jesus, uh-huh. terrible thing is happening that Billy Crystal is doing. And you write about it in the book how a lot of the mm-hmm. radio version of you is complaints. I'm not happy with things. How do those two things square up?
I don't know if they do. You start to just realize it's all just a giant smear and it's like, it's not compartmentalized nearly to the degree that it might seem like it could be. It's just like, it feels like a tornado in my head most of the time and we'll see where we land with stuff. And I could go a variety of like the tornado could launch me into a variety of directions. But it really, they're both me, the positive stuff. And also, I will say that any negative aspect of that Billy Crystal thing, it's like, first of all, I'm not punching down. I'm not making fun of Billy Crystal. He did it on a television show. He could buy and sell me. He did it on a TV show. He is as lauded as anybody has been. And he did something that was just so tone deaf and ridiculous that it's like, you can't let that skate. Like that's gotta be goofed on. And so that's what that was. It's just like, I really don't like anytime I feel like I'm punching down or anything like that. That is one of the things I actively try to avoid is keeping the targets fair.
Is that hard to figure out sometimes? Because now you're a pretty powerful person. You might want to make fun of someone who, you know, do you have to calculate the power differential?
No, it's probably easier though now that the world believes that as well now, where the world did not always believe that. And there's less opportunity now for just straight up cheap, shitty jokes about targets where you're punching down or picking on people who are already up against it in terms of being picked on by the world. Like there's less latitude for that stuff anyway. So that makes it's not like I'm just like, oh, I don't do it because I don't want to get because the world doesn't want to hear it. It's like, no, I don't want to do it because I don't want to hear it. But the world is aligning with that approach more and more now. So it's like people get called out for things that are just being awful to other people now, where they definitely didn't before. And I mean, look, I've done my learning with that stuff, and like everybody who makes jokes has, but it's also not that hard either to just learn. Like, what, like if you're going to put yourself in the position where you are have any sort of opinion that you want someone to hear and respect or consider, then you also have to put yourself in the position of growing, and that your opinions might change too. You can't just say like, well, I got to the finish line on this. Everything I think is right until the end of time, and I want you to listen and support my opinions on this. It's like, no, you have to be ready to say that, hey, maybe I'm completely wrong on that after all. And then I can grow, and then I can say that I grew to other people. And it's just the process. And I'm glad that that's where the world is at and heading.
Well, so now the book is out and everyone knows about this thing that you didn't talk about much before. I imagine you've got some reactions. How do you feel about the reactions you've gotten?
It's pretty freaky in a lot of ways, because I really worked very hard to never share any of these things with people outside of my immediate life, including like friends didn't know, like my best friends didn't know about this. It really was. It really was immediate family, and that was it. So there's a very liberating thing to just say it, and now everybody knows it, and I've unburdened myself in a lot of ways for the stuff I've been carrying for decades. But then there's something very odd that goes hand in hand with that, that it's like, oh my God, all these people I've never met before know these bizarre stories from my past, these painful things. They know because I told them. And that was part of the deal with this, and it was a very scary thing going into it, and it stayed pretty scary, and I'm still scared of it, because I've told people way more than I ever thought I would have told them so that I could tell them. And now they know, but ultimately it's a very positive thing, because reaction wise, I have gotten incredible reactions from people who have experienced things for themselves, experienced it with family members, and you just start to realize, I had gone into it hoping that there would be a thing where it's like, look, of course my story only happened to me, and I'm not expecting that to be a universal experience, but the larger themes are much more universal. The idea of something happened to you, you were embarrassed about it because you didn't want to be different, and you swallow that embarrassment, and then that morphs and gets twisted into shame and guilt because it went unaddressed and unacknowledged. And a lot of people have versions of that that I have heard, like that they had their own thing that they swallowed and did not properly express or process, and they paid a price for it. And so they want to unburden, and there's such power in unburdening yourself with that and not feeling alone, just not feeling alone with it.
I'll give you just a dollop of advice here. Cause I've had people come to me and say, oh, your podcast saved my life, or your book saved my life, or something that you did saved my life. And it kind of freaked me out for a long time, because I was like, well, what if I had made a really bad episode of a podcast? You know, what if I just screwed something up? Is your life in my hands? And I asked John Darnielle of the Mountain Goats about this, and because he writes a lot of very personal, painful kinds of things. And I know people have come to him and say, your music saved my life. And I'm like, how do you handle that? And John said, well, okay, first of all, you didn't save their lives. they save their own lives. They might not realize that they have the power and the strength to do that. So they just think it's somebody else did them a favor, but they saved their own lives. He said, what you did was you made a tool, you know, like he says with his music, he says, I'm an artisan. I can craft these tools. People can use those tools to get themselves out of bad situations. And that gives me a lot of pride as a tool maker, but they're the ones doing the job. And that helped me a lot.
Sure. No, I appreciate you saying that. That's actually outstanding advice. It's not actual. It makes it sound like I was expecting horrible advice by using the word actually. Like, that's actually good advice. I didn't expect you'd say something smart. but I mean, that is great advice. And I don't know why I use the word actually.
That's okay.
But I've gotten people over the years through things on the radio show where people have said things along those lines. And I've just tried to depersonalize that for a long time because I do know that I need to, if it's successful and meaningful to people, it's like, well, then let me do more of it. But I need to just do it the way I was doing it. I wasn't doing it for anyone other than myself. And I need to keep, that's how I need to keep seeing it in terms of the way, when I do things, is that I'm doing this for myself. And if someone gets something from it, then that's what they got from it. And if they got a laugh from it, then they got a laugh from it. If they got more from it than that, then they got more from it. If they didn't like it, then they didn't like it. It's just like, I'm okay with all of those reactions. I just need to be able to do it, though, without thinking that I'm doing it for people. Like, that's a burden I cannot figure out how I could possibly be creative and carry the weight of things.
Tom Sharpling's memoir is called It Never Ends, but it ends on page 279, so he's a liar. Next time on Depression Mode, singer-songwriter Amos Lee reached a point where he was getting panic attack after panic attack. And he doesn't mean just feeling kind of jumpy.
The body can't really handle that because of the amount of adrenaline that goes into a panic attack, a true panic attack. Like, I hear people say, like, oh, man, I'm having a panic attack. I'm like, no, you're not. I'm having a real panic attack. Like, nah, dude, if you were having a real panic attack, you'd be sweating in the corner and you would not be talking to me right now. Like, you'd be freaking the fuck out.
If people support our show through a small donation, we will continue to make new shows. If not, we can't. If you donate, you are making Depression Mode, and we thank you. If you haven't donated yet, it's easy. You can find a level that works for you, MaximumFun.org/join. Also, give our sponsors a shot. Use those discount codes they offer. You're getting good stuff cheaper, and you're helping our show. Speaking of helping, we love it when you recommend Depression Mode to friends. Also, something that matters a lot, hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write reviews. That helps more people find out about the show, which helps our mission of getting those conversations happening. I want you to know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text HOME to 741-741. Let us know who you want me to interview, what issues you want to hear more about. We take requests. Send us an electric mail at depressionmode@maximumfun.org. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. Great talk going on over there. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter at John Moe. Hello, Credits listeners. When he was in college, the poet Lord Byron kept a tame bear in his dorm room as a pet. What college? Arizona State. Now is Cambridge. Depresh Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hi, my name is Cleo. I'm a Canadian living in Brisbane, Australia. I wanted to tell you to give yourself a fucking break. That even on your worst days, I know that you're trying. And that's beautiful.
Depresh Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.